Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Microsoft Teams is helping a bicycle company reinvent the way that they work.
We make bicycles for everyday riders. Once the pandemic hit, we started doing virtual visits.
All of a sudden, we could open up our showroom to customers around the world.
Learn more at Microsoft.com/Teams.
Welcome into the RotoWire NFL podcast brought to you by our friends over at Dynasty Owner. I'm your host, John McKechnie, joined as always by Mario Puig. We got a loaded show lined up for you guys today. We're going to be talking about a best ball that Mario and I are currently participating in. We're both in very, very different draft slots, so we're going to kind of get into how that draft slot informs how we're approaching the rest of our roster builds. So that'll be coming up in a little bit. We're also going to get into Mario's 35-round NFFC best ball. That's deep. You're really getting into the weeds at round 35. I don't even know who even is there.
That's so up my alley, though. I was shocked to learn that this was a contest because I've always been the idiot in those, you know, 20 and 18 round best ball leagues, thinking like, man, I wish I could get another 5 rounds so I could get these great picks like James Robinson or something.
Yeah, Chris Moore. This is like, the year.
My team's all right, but I really wish I could have added Tavian Feaster in the 21st round. So anyway, this draft is kind of interesting because it's a different ecosystem when it's that long. But we'll talk about that, and certainly we'll have our best ball 10 example to kind of contrast with it.
Yes, so looking forward to that. But we had some breaking news happen. Breaking, maybe not the best word here, but...
No, it is.
Yes, you're right. It actually is. If you're out there listening, earlier Thursday, it was reported that Deebo Samuel suffered a broken foot earlier this week on Tuesday. According to Ian Rappaport of NFL Network, looks like he underwent surgery already. And the timeline is about 3 to 4 months, 12 to 16 weeks. So that's a pretty lengthy recovery time that obviously puts his start of the season in serious jeopardy here and maybe well into the season as well. We, of course, expect him to be able to play this year at some juncture, but this really changes things for him. for the San Francisco offense. And I think, you know, maybe even just like the San Francisco outlook on this season as a whole here, because he was just such an important cog there for them towards the end of last year. So what is your initial reactions here? What are we supposed to make of this?
Well, I think it's more or less going to be fine. It's, I guess, most concerning for me relative to Jimmy Garoppolo, actually, just because I don't know if he has the abilities to offset the loss of containment of Debo's placement in the early season game plan. Like, he should be fine to play, first of all. Like, if at most he would seemingly miss something like 2 weeks, and even that might indicate something like a setback, because this is, I guess, a Jones fracture, which is a pretty sharp distinction from the Lisfranc sort of fracture that guys like Marquise Brown and Cam Newton had. The Jones fracture, I guess, is more of like a 2 month kind of thing. So maybe Debo would miss some training camp or all of it even. And I guess the other thing is, it's like aggravation, you know, setbacks. Avoiding those is like the main key to this, because the 49ers have Trent Taylor on the team. He actually had a Jones fracture last year, and they kind of screwed it up, it seems like, because he just kept having these I don't know if it was technically a setback, but I feel like he had like multiple procedures done on it. And I remember they kept having to adjust and then kind of like obscure his prognosis. Like, they'd just be saying, yeah, he should be back pretty soon, and then it's just that he never came back, never played last year. So there is a way for it to go completely wrong, and there's already found a way to make that happen. But presumably they won't do what they did to screw up the Trent Taylor case. And if they don't screw it up by rushing him back too quick, then, you know, knock on wood, this should be something that more or less resolves itself in 8-10 weeks, something like that. So unless they do screw it up like they did with Taylor, I think we can expect Debo, or, you know, have a reasonable amount of optimism that he'll be out there week one. But maybe he does something more like a 25-30 snap per game kind of workload for the first 2-4 weeks, as opposed to 55-65 sort of snap workload. But I would generally say it's only Garoppolo who loses something here. And given the way Shanahan is so crafty as a play caller, the 49ers might fully withstand any particular thing they lose in the passing game by just kind of coming up with more tricks in the ground game, because they need like 2 or 3 weeks of tricks, and I feel like Shanahan can come up with that. If it was an entire season problem, that'd be different, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. So, all right. So it sounds like Samuel will be back by September, so won't miss a ton of time into the season if the recovery ends up going according to plan. But with that, I mean, does this change your outlook on anyone else in terms of these 49ers pass catchers? Is this something that, you know, maybe nudges George Kittle up your board a little bit? Does it give you any interest in maybe taking a flyer on Kendrick Bourne late? Does it bump Brandon Ayuk up a little bit more? Anything like that?
I think the markets will react to this, but I don't think they really should. To me, it's just about Garoppolo, really. Like, I think this is the kind of thing that might deprive him of one or two good games that he would otherwise be pretty likely to have if Debo were at full. But I don't think I think Kittle, first of all, is pretty much maxed out. And I think if people go elevating him on the basis of this injury, they're crazy. I think if anything, that guy's marked for regression, both because he's got a pretty long durability history that no one talks about, and because it's really hard to continue for a third year in a row 2 years of kind of like superhuman per target numbers. Like, I know that he runs for 8.5 yards after the catch per catch because he's insanely good at running after the catch, but even the best players get hit with meaningless regression from time to time, and I think Kittle is kind of just due for that sort of arbitrary bad luck. And I don't think that Debo playing less creates any new ceiling for him. Like, I feel like he's already there. Ayuk, I would imagine, is who gets chased the most from this, and I won't have any part of that. Like, I think he's fine for the scheme, but you know what? If Debo's not on the field, that's one of those things where it starts to change the whole calculus of the offense. And whereas Ayuk, I think, works perfectly fine in theory in the Shanahan offense with Kittle and Debo on the field, because the defense just can't, it can only give so much attention to Ayuk at that point. And like the ways that they, pay less attention are sort of things that he's good at exploiting if things do end up that way. But if there is no Debo and if they're allowed to focus more on Ayuk, then any sort of deficiency in his skill set matters more. And I never really thought he showed as much skill as like his numbers and as much as the NFL scouts thought that he showed at Arizona State, because it was just these plays that happen over and over where he kind of just takes a slant that he, you know, he runs the slant well, whatever, but he runs for these, you know, 70 yard touchdowns because he splits the corner and the safety after, and there's no weak side linebacker assisting in the coverage. There's nobody getting in the middle of the field to disrupt this throwing lane. It's always there, and all he ever does is run a slant and then split the safety in the corner, and it's going to be tougher than that. So it's not something that where I just see the usage going straight to Ayuk and him doing the same thing that he would have done otherwise, or like the same things that Debo would have done with those targets. I think you have to assume a diminishing return even if he gets more targets, and I don't think that's I don't think you can take that for granted either, because we could just as easily see them do sort of like a committee approach. Like Jalen Hurd might get, you know, 10 more snaps a game, and we might see Pettis and Bourne get a handful of more snaps. It might be something like that rather than anything new coming about. But well, I'll say either way, I've believed this the whole offseason. I think the receiver that you buy in this team, aside from Debo, of course, is pretty much Trent Taylor in the last round. And I still think that, but it doesn't have anything to do with Debo's injury.
Oh, okay, just based on, you know, you're
I think he'll displace Kendrick Bourne.
Okay.
Like, I don't think Kendrick Bourne is that great. I think Kendrick Bourne's just like a swing backup type to Shanahan, and Taylor is the starting slot receiver if he's healthy. So he's got an injury history at this point. Like, again, he was the Jones fracture last year, and they screwed it up a bunch of ways. But if he's fine now, I mean, before he broke his foot, I remember the San Francisco beat writers talking about how they thought he was going to lead the team in receptions last year. So I think that in the last round, you could do far worse than him to begin with. So I just hope that, you know, I hope I can keep getting him there. And I hope that this Debo injury doesn't result in Trent Taylor going in like the 15th round now. I expect Ayuk to jump, and I don't expect Taylor to jump. So fingers crossed there.
Yeah, I'll be personally a little bit surprised if we see a mainstreaming of Trent Taylor here. I think that you have it right where Ayuk, you know, the first round rookie sees the draft helium way sooner than any sort of Trent Taylor bump. I think we will be well into August before like that sort of hype train maybe starts coming out of camp.
Let us hope.
So looking at Ayuk one more time from a different angle, just in terms of other receivers that you can get in similar parts of the draft as him. So you got like guys like James Washington, Denzel Mims, a fellow rookie. I'll skip Alshon Jeffrey because that's like a whole other can of worms. Alan Lazard. So like, where would you like view Ayuk among that sort of tier?
So I didn't really have any big problem with him at that price tag. Like, he's going later on best ball tens the past week than James Washington. So I think that's reasonable. It's like that they're kind of similar categories of guys who are in passing games that could be pretty good, but aren't guaranteed to be. They're sort of fixed in their functions, but they could both be good at those particular functions. And if the offense as a whole is healthy enough, they might kind of go along for the ride. But I don't think I want to pay more than that for Ayuk, and I think he's definitely going to start costing more than that. And even at that original starting price, as much as I think it's justifiable to spend it on him, I'm still not the one making that pick. Like, I'm taking these guys going later yet. Players like Randall Cobb and Laviska Shenault, I those two over Duke, and that was before we're talking the price increase. So I know I'm not going to get anything, or I would anticipate I'm not going to get any shares, because I just don't think I project him any better this year than Trent Taylor. And it's like, why would I pay, you know, 4 or 5 rounds more for somebody that I just don't think is going to do more?
Interesting. Yeah, that's a good way of framing it. And just looking at the ADP right now, I see Antonio Brown sneaking into around the...
Oh, Steven Sims. God, why is that still happening? Steven Sims down at 220 in the best ball 10s in the past week, whereas Ayuk was way up. Ayuk's up at 187. People are taking DeeDee Westbrook over Steven Sims. I don't know what people are looking at. Anyway, yeah, there's some receivers that I like in this range quite a bit more than Ayuk, even though Ayuk is not among the most poorly priced in the range, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Support for this podcast comes from Wild Turkey Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. Let's tune in to their one-on-one with Jamal, a real bartender from Old Fourth Ward in Atlanta.
I really get into the backstory of whatever I'm pouring. Out of respect, there are literally years of experience behind these bottles. Wild Turkey, same recipe since 1942. If you want a true classic, this is what you want to order.
Wild Turkey. Wild Turkey Distilling Company, Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. Copyright 2020, Campari America, New York, New York. Never compromise, drink responsibly.
All right, so let's get into the best ball that you and I are participating over on Best Ball 10. So that means it's a full point PPR. Mario, you had the third pick. I had the 11th pick, and I was dreading having a pick at that stage because you run into that tier of running backs that's very, very difficult to sort out. Would like to hear your opinion on some of those guys, though. And then just kind of what it means for the rest of my draft. I've never been the tight end in the first round type of guy, even at like Gronk's peak or anything like that. So before we get to mine, let's start with you going with Zeke at 3.
Yeah, so I guess this was kind of in the news since the last podcast too, but he, of course, was diagnosed with COVID, and I don't know I haven't seen any reports about when they think he was exposed and when he was tested and what sort of timeline they're looking at. But as of, I want to say, 2 days ago, they were saying he had no symptoms, that it was either a random test or a test that they did because they did some sort of like contact tracing, basically. In any case, that's such a weird, morbid subject, and I don't really know what's responsible to offer on it. But at least, he's in that age group where, as far as I know, there hasn't been any consistent, not like any statistically significant group of people of his sort of demographics ending up with any sort of bad symptoms. And yet there was that Von Miller thing, and he's over 30, so it's hard to tell where the line is on this stuff or what anything means in any given case at all. But he was expressing some sort of like ongoing like lung conditioning the difficulties, like he was trying to build up his wind break basically, and he just couldn't do it as quickly as he thought he would when he was recovering. However, that was a few months ago, and I haven't heard anything about Von Miller still struggling to catch his breath. So hopefully that's well in the past for Von Miller, because if it is well in the past for him, then a player like Zeke should be fine. But yeah, I did think about it for a second. I was like, I don't know. I guess it felt like not enough was known about what it means for him for me to not pick him at the third pick when he would otherwise be like clearly the pick that I would make. So felt a little anxious about it, but I went ahead with him anyway, because I feel like if everything were all equal, there would be a case to take him as high as first overall. Not that I would personally make that case, and I certainly don't rank him ahead of Saquon or McCaffrey, but he's in that kind of upside category when everything is right. So I think there's a distinction between him and Kamara, the next option that I would have considered, because Kamara basically needs the touchdowns to reach the kind of value that people are accustomed to with him, whereas Zeke's going to get plenty of catches, nowhere near Kamara's level, of course, but still plenty of catches, and the Cowboys compulsively give him 20-plus carries a game, which, there's not many players in that category him.
Yeah, it's like him and McCaffrey as far as like that level of rushing workload is concerned. So yeah, that definitely made sense. And between him and Kamara, I think that would have been a tougher call this time a year ago. But I think after last season, I lean Zeke, probably like 80-20 over Kamara. Like if I'm picking three and they're both there, 10 times over, I'm going Zeke 8 out of those times. So for me, I was at pick 11, and there was a number of running backs there on the board that were appealing. Austin Eckler was there. Derrick Henry and Nick Chubb had just gone off the board. So I was looking at guys like Eckler, Kenyon Drake, Miles Sanders, and so on. But knowing the guy that was picking 12th, I figured that he would have gone with Kelsey, and I wouldn't have been able to get Kelsey on the back end of this wheel. So I just went with Kelsey and just kind of hoped that he would help sort out that running back group for me a little bit and make my choice a little bit easier. I wanted to leave this with Kelsey picking at this stage of the first round, so I just went with it. I just feel strongly, especially in PPR, I think he's just, you know, pretty much infallible. It's pretty hard to argue against him as the number one fantasy tight end. And with the way that the board fell, I liked going with him over, you know, one of the receivers or one of those running backs there at 11. So that definitely changes my approach the rest of the draft, but I was happy to go with Kelsey there leading things off.
Yeah, 11, especially with the way that this particular draft order went about, 11 has to be the worst pick. Sorry. Just because you're in that, like, that terrible point where I like Eckler. I would have taken Eckler, but there's like that weekly floor drop off from Henry and Chubb and Mixon to Eckler, if only because it's just Eckler is kind of like the more affordable version of Kamara, where, you know, he has no shot at imitating the rushing functions of these guys that he's going right next to, but you're banking on him playing with staying involved in a passing game that's healthy enough to make up the difference. And, you know, people get more spooked about the Chargers than they do the Saints because Drew Brees scores a lot of touchdowns. Tyrod Taylor generally has not, and so on. But I probably would have gone Eckler there just because the way that the markets are looking right now in most drafts, like it's just really difficult to get the running back kind of upside that you want after the fourth or fifth round or so. And when you're stuck at the ends of the draft order, you get stuck with these really unfair, basically positional runs sometimes where you make a pick that like every sort of value model tells you to, and it doesn't really matter because it's I guess the most extreme instances I've ever seen of these were in my home leagues where I'd go in and take running backs in the first three rounds while all the other 11 people who are, you know, from Wisconsin and are big Packers fans all take quarterbacks every single pick. And so it's like you get to your third round pick and it's like the best quarterbacks like Eli Manning. And you're like, what the hell happened? So, yeah, when you're at the polls of the draft order, and you go into that long, whatever that is, 24, 23 pick stretch, it's like there's a lot that can go wrong at the running back position in that weight. So that's what I probably would have done there. But yeah, it's in terms of the value, it's like I would have taken Eckler. But if Dave had taken Miles Sanders and then Drake, I wouldn't have known really what to do at the second pick. It's like I guess I would have nothing wrong with Travis Kelce. But I guess I would have had to take a receiver there because I wouldn't have wanted any of the running backs left. Like I'm too leery of Josh Jacobs and Aaron Jones to take them over a receiver like Tyreek Hill or Julio or Hopkins.
Okay, yeah. So the way that I viewed it, I figured that Eckler would be gone after the Kelce pick. I didn't know who would be next of that cluster of picks between Drake, Sanders, or Jacobs. So Drake comes off the board with the first pick in round two. So I was stuck between Sanders and Jacobs. And, you know, I did some comparison shopping. And I like Jacobs a lot, but it just feels like there's so much room for, you know, for a volume increase for Sanders and, like, what he showed down the stretch last year when he was healthy and kind of that number one in Philly. I had kind of forgotten how impressive he was down that stretch. So, you know, with that, I know that Philadelphia just lost one of their offensive linemen to an Achilles, so that stinks for sure. But I still think that Sanders is leaps and bounds and better than anyone else at running back in Philadelphia, and I don't think that he's going to come off the field necessarily on passing downs the way that Jacobs, you know, probably will between Richard and Lynn Bowden. So, and I know that Mayock has kind of fluffed up Jacobs' pass catching and saying that he'll be a little bit more involved this year. If that's true, then I think Jacobs would have been a fine pick at 13 or whatever. But I knew that Sanders would be involved in both, and I think that there was enough room for improvement from Sanders this year on a better team than the Raiders. So
yeah, sorry, real quick. Yeah, I think it was definitely the right pick because actually it's not often anymore that Sanders even gets that far in the draft order. Like in the NFFC best ball draft that I did, I'm pretty sure he went seventh. Really? So, or eighth, something like that. Like I took Joe Mixon with my first pick and somebody took Sanders before my pick. So I think I had the 10th pick. It might have been, so maybe they took him 9th and for some reason Mixon was available at 10. But in any case, people in the high stakes leagues are taking Sanders consistently over Nick Chubb and they're chasing him in the top 8, top 10 now.
Wow, that might be a little bit rich for my blood. I certainly wouldn't take him over Chubb even in PPR. But
or I. Yeah, I guess you're not surprised by that.
Yeah, I think we're in lockstep on that one for sure. But yeah, either way, Sanders had like really promising target share and like, you know, what he was doing, the efficiency with his targets compared to Jacobs. So maybe you could argue that Jacobs has room for improvement there. But I know for sure that Sanders already has that element of his game nailed down and it's going to be consistent. So I liked Sanders there. So leaving this you know, sort of wheel at 11 and 14 with Kelce and with Sanders, I just love the receivers that I'm going to be able to get in the mid 30s enough to where I was fine with leaving the Tyreek Hill types on the board there because I knew I was going to attack that next tier down the line with my next selection. So that's kind of the we're not super far into this draft beyond that. We're just towards the end of the second round now. I know you just made your second pick not too long ago. But yeah, that's the way I wanted to set it up. I wanted to leave with at least one running back from picking at the end of the first, and then set myself up to attack receiver hard in these next few rounds.
Yeah, and I think that's in most cases the sort of approach you want to take is assuming that you get at least one really expensive running back early in the first three rounds. And my personal ideal is to get two running backs in those first three. And the thing that keeps occurring with me, and it happened in this draft too, is if I have one of the first three picks, I'm taking Lamar Jackson in the second round because I always take that running back, be it Christian McCaffrey, Saquon, Ezekiel Elliott. And then in the late second round, I don't like the running backs anymore. And my plan in the first place, regardless of where I'm positioned in the draft order, is I'm going to hammer the wide receiver position in rounds 4 through 8 because there's just you almost have to call it a surplus. I mean, with how much of the league has gone 3 wide receiver, it's like in that NFFC league, there's guys like Tyler Boyd and Christian Kirk who, in my opinion, have pretty obvious top 15 upside in PPR, and yet they're going in like the 9th round because there's just so much – there's such a glut of receivers who project for that kind of 1,100-yard to 1,200-yard sort of baseline, and the people who are spending on Tyreek and Hopkins and Julio – Chris Godwin, whoever in the second round, they're not necessarily picking those players because they're maybe taking the running backs at that point. Like unless you're in a draft full of true zero running back sort of disciples, you generally don't have the scenario where you get to the 7th and you're like, oh crap, I have to take Mecole Hardman as my wide receiver too. Like that doesn't really happen. It's like you can wait at receiver and still not really be tested for getting enough depth. Whereas at running back, it's pretty easy to get to the 4th round and just be like, I want to quit this draft.
Right. So I'm worried about that already, but you know, we'll see what and especially if I double tap receiver coming up here, which I might if the board ends up falling.
Honestly, there's no need because there's going to be guys in like the 5th, the 6th, the 7th, and I swear, you know, if I pick Mecole, it'll be because I was going to do it anyway and not because I'm trying to break your stack. But just for like a general strategy thing, I would try to get Mecole and maybe Watkins too. You can get Watkins really cheap. People are acting like Watkins isn't going to play this year, which is I don't know what anyone ever thinks about Sammy. I feel like he never gets understood. But yeah, if you get Kelce and Hardman and Watkins for, let's say, like you're the first pick for Kelce, the 8th or 7th pick for Mecole, and then like the 10th pick for Watkins, that could get you the hot, you know, not that we want to think in these lines or anything, but if Tyreek Hill were to miss time, you know, that would basically give you the highest scoring Chiefs pass catcher any week that Hill was not.
Man, yeah, that would be a pretty legit setup. So that's something that I'm definitely going to have to consider. But, you know, talking about maybe not going to receivers there with those next picks in the mid-30s, I've noticed the internet has caught up or started talking a little bit more about Calvin Ridley, someone that we focused on a couple weeks ago. And that's not to say that like we started the hype train or anything, but I'm just saying that I've noticed it's gotten noticeably louder. I felt like I hadn't seen anything about Calvin Ridley until like early June. And then, you know, we talked about him on the podcast, and like this week he's been like everyone's like favorite sleeper. I'm on the really? Calvin Ridley hype train. Yeah. This and that. So I've seen, maybe it's just the, you know, Google listening to my thoughts enough to where like they're just going to put more Calvin Ridley things in front of me. But either way, I'm seeing it, man.
Nice. I hadn't seen that. I had seen previous to our podcast a handful of sharp people expressing, you know, Calvin Ridley optimism. So, you know, John, if you want, and I guess I should have seen to this before I got into this podcast with you. But in that we could maybe use this as a point to switch toward that NFFC best ball draft, which I'm doing because it's well beyond the second round. Sure. And I took Calvin Ridley in it. So let's see. Oops, I'm actually on the clock. Sorry, guys.
While you're on the clock, I can hit this read here from our friends at Dynasty Owner.
Oh, yeah, you can do that.
So before we switch on over to our NFFC discussion, we got a message from our friends over at Dynasty Owner. You guys have heard of them. The best fantasy football leagues are those where every owner constantly pays attention, responds to trade offers, changes their lineup, and are always looking to improve their team. There is no offseason for these owners. That's who you're challenging yourself against in Dynasty Owner, other elite fantasy football players who are committed to competing. Dynasty Owner is the only fantasy football platform with a patent game using actual NFL salaries and contracts. Combine this with a salary cap, elite trading options, advanced team rosters, and devoted elite owners to compete against, and you're faced with the same decisions NFL owners and general managers must make. If you're ready to take on the best, then don't miss out. Join the waitlist at dynastyowner.com. That's dynastyowner.com. All right, Mario. So we were just talking about the draft that's ongoing for you, that you took Ridley in. Have you made your selection yet?
Yeah, I did, and it's going to sound very weird for a number of reasons, but we'll explain it. It's a different kind of economy with this sort of league, because when it's 35 rounds, and it by the way, this it's a $150 league, so it's different than the best ball tens, because it's like the high stakes best ball equivalent basically, and there's some sort of tournament payout structure that I didn't read because I'm stupid, but the basic difference is it's 35 rounds. It includes not just defenses like best ball 10 drafts do. It also includes team kickers, which I don't know what I'm going to do about that. I'll probably screw it up. I'm going to make every other pick perfectly because I handled team kicker wrong or something. But because it's 35 rounds, the way I'm reading that is you can kind of pad, especially the receiver position, but also the running back position a little bit in the later rounds in a way that you can't at quarterback, because quarterback, it's just, you know, we got like 22 starters who we're pretty sure are going to start all year. And then you're down to a bunch of guys who just don't really have secure playing time. And then that group itself is pretty thin. Like be out. Like we're probably going to see Nick Foles go off the board in this draft by like the 14th round or something, because if you can get three quarterbacks who are guaranteed to start all year, I feel like that's a pretty nice it's good to have that at quarterback, because whereas you can pad your running back and receiver positions late with guys who have they're like practice squad and bottom of the roster types. But as long as they make the team, all that they really need is for someone ahead of them to get hurt to get on the field. And at quarterback, it's like some of these cases we can guess who would start in the event of an injury, and we might even pick some of those players in this draft. But it's just going to be a lot easier to end up wasting a backup quarterback kind of pick than it is a backup running back or receiver. So especially, it's basically like, do you want to go into the year with a third quarterback like Jalen Hurts,
or would you rather go into the year with my third quarterback, who's Ryan Tannehill, and just, you know, make like a Trent Taylor pick later instead of the, I don't know, Mike Williams pick that you got instead of the quarterbacks? Like, that's the kind of trade-off that I feel like people are going to have to look at here. And so that's why I took Tannehill as my third quarterback in the 11th round. And I took Dak Prescott in the fourth round, which was six picks after someone took Kyler Murray in the fourth round. So I've got Jimmy Garoppolo in the ninth round, Tannehill in the 11th. I think I'm set at quarterback now, and I really like the way it looks, because I think between the three, and by the way, that it's not just that it's the 35 round dynamic, it's the touchdowns are 6 point per passing touchdown in this. So I feel like that raises the stakes. Like, waiting on quarterback may well prove the right call in a league like this, but it's less likely to because of that 6 point distinction. And it also doesn't create as much of like the rushing loophole specifically. So like, if you're banking on Tyrod in every league giving you whatever 400 rushing yards to offset only throwing 22 passing touchdowns or whatever, in this league, it might not really make the difference you expect. And so I've put a pretty high priority on having my quarterback position solved, because there's still one guy in here who has just like one quarterback. And I know that a lot of other people are going to be looking to get their backups and their third quarterback in these upcoming rounds. So I'm hoping that by taking Tannehill, someone I normally don't target, by the way, I'm hoping that by having him and Jimmy Garoppolo behind Dak, that I can just go hammering wide receiver and running back from this point. But I think I'm doing pretty good at those spots, too. So I had the 10th pick. I took Joe Mixon, which surprised me. I didn't think he would be there. Miles Sanders, John, actually went 7th in this draft, was not only ahead of Joe Mixon, it was ahead of Derrick Henry and Kenyon Drake. So Kenyon Drake was the pick immediately before mine. I have Mixon well ahead of him, so I was pretty lucky to have that.
Sure.
And I knew what I was going to do. Like, when I saw Mixon, I was like, I'm definitely taking a running back with my second pick too, because Austin Eckler and Nick Chubb are on the board. I bet one of them is going to make it back. And it wasn't Eckler, but Chubb did. So I've got, in the first round, I've got Mixon. The second round, I've got Chubb. Third round, I took AJ Brown. And this is because it's best ball, and because it's kind of like this high stakes tournament sort of scenario, I was more willing to take AJ Brown than I would have been normally, because the way I was thinking of it was basically who has the absolute highest upside at this pick. And I was choosing between AJ Brown and Mike Evans, Kenny Galladay, Odell Beckham, Amari Cooper. Those were the options. And I basically just thought, yeah, AJ Brown doesn't have as high of a floor as any of those guys. And he could kind of just disappear if the Titans can run all day, which they always do if they have the chance. But then I thought, well, not that I want this to happen, but like, if Derrick Henry got hurt, AJ Brown might go from like the 8 to the highest scoring wide receiver since Antonio Brown. And so I took him there because it was like, he's going to be good. I'm not worried about AJ Brown having 800 yards this year. I'm just worried about him having like four useful games that are huge and no other good ones. Mm-hmm. But I think he'll do at least that. So I'm not worried about getting less than that. If I can get more than that, you know, maybe my team would be cooking in that case. But yeah, so I'll just read out the list here. It's Joe Mixon in the first, Nick Chubb in the second, AJ Brown in the third. I took Dak in the fourth because it wasn't clear at that point how the quarterbacks were going to work. Like, people took Lamar Jackson earlier than usual by about six picks, Patrick Mahomes earlier by about the same amount. Like I said, Kyler Murray went six picks ahead of where I took Dak. So I was worried about getting to my sixth round pick and having to choose between like Carson Wentz and I don't know, Daniel Jones or something like that. And I don't want that kind of anxiety. So I just took Dak. I was like, this might be a reach, but whatever. I'm not worried about Dak. And the 6 points per passing touchdown makes me pretty anxious about punting on quarterback. So I decided to just kind of settle it there. Then we got to the favorite part of the draft for me this year, which is when we get to hammer those mid-round receivers, because it's you just can't screw up in that part of the draft if you're taking receivers. Like, every pick you're going to feel so smart because it's all good. You can't really go wrong with Calvin Ridley, who I got in the fifth round after Dak Prescott in the fourth. And some of the picks that were after that were – you know, the Seattle guys, I'm not getting much of them. I think they're closer to maxed out than people think, but they're not going to hurt anybody. They're obviously very good players. Terry McLaurin, who I love. let's see, DJ Chark, really like him. Chark, McLaurin, and Ridley in that range of the draft are probably my three favorite picks. And I didn't get McLaurin or Chark on the way back, but I did get Michael Gallup, who I get to stack with Dak Prescott, obviously. Ideally, I would get Blake Jarwin a little later, or maybe CeeDee Lamb a little later, to just kind of lock in, like the highest, one of the highest pass catching scores and what should be one of the highest scoring passing offenses, which I'm already, you know, harnessing the benefits of with Dak a little bit.
Quick U-turn on one of the guys that you mentioned there in that mid round range of receivers. If I'm a DJ Chark skeptic, sell me on him.
Well, I know he seemed a little bit like he disappeared last year in the second half, and I'm guessing people are kind of souring on him a tiny bit because they're thinking like, oh yeah, he was just a flash in the pan those first 4 weeks. I was right to kind of not take him seriously in the first place. But I think a couple things, like he got nicked up with something in the second half. I can't remember what it was. And he was still getting a lot of targets. It was just Minshew had some bad games. Like he was struggling, I remember, with the pass rush quite a bit in the season's second half. But I think that Chark is pretty clearly good because he posted good numbers in an efficiency sense last year, and the volume was, of course, good. And he's one of the most athletic players in the league, and I don't know if people are overlooking that maybe because he was, whatever, like a late second round pick who didn't do anything as a rookie. But he's like one of those 40-inch vertical, 130-inch broad jump kind of guys, and he runs in the low 4.3s at 6'4". He was running a lot of snaps in the slot last year too, so that's something that might not mean much at a glance. But when someone that athletic and that big is running from the slot, I think that sets up a really high upside scenario because he's getting some of those easier short and intermediate range targets to supplement the downfield shots that he's taken. So it's like you're getting some of the Chris Godwin routes and some of the Mike Evans routes at the same time, and you have a reason to believe that the receiver is good at both of them. So I think Chark has pretty clearly top 12 upside at receiver, and the only reason I don't have more shares of him than I do is because I also really like Ridley and McLaurin, and I hate not getting whichever one that I'm not picking. But yeah, it's like I can't trade up and take them all, otherwise I would.
Yeah, okay. So that's definitely a good case, and I think I was surprised at how well he did last year relative to his rookie season. I think I got a little bit down on him after his rookie season, but like you said, the athleticism is certainly there, and the ankle injury late in the season slowed his roll, but he'll be back this year, and he'll be that true number one for the Jags.
Yeah.
Do you have any reservations just about this Jaguars offense or passing game in general with Minshew back there?
I mean, I don't want to get really high hopes about it, and I know I saw PFF say like Gardner Minshew had the higher grade between him and Kyler Murray as rookies, and that's stupid. But I think there's something to Minshew. Like if he was just useless, if he wasn't any good, I have trouble explaining how he did what he did last year, even if it wasn't a full season, even if he had some bad games. It's like good quarterbacks who are veterans have some bad games. I'm not going to use a couple bad games in a rookie season as a reason to write him off. Like Minshew has shown a lot more to this point than Drew Locke, who goes something like three rounds earlier than him in most drafts that I've seen. So it's one of those things, like I'm not feeling particularly safe about Minshew and he's one of those guys who might be better in fantasy than real life anyway. Like he might have turnover proneness in real life, something like that. But he ran for a lot of yards last year and he didn't score any rushing touchdowns. So it's something has to give there. Like he either will run for fewer yards and have a similar touchdown rate, or he's going to have a flurry of rushing touchdowns. And if he's running well and if he's throwing as well as he did last year, and he's got not just Chark, but Laviska Shenault now. And I think, by the way, Laviska Shenault is someone you'll want to try to stack with DJ Chark if you take them in best ball, because he goes later in some drafts than others. But I think D.D. Westbrook is just going way too high, and you'll want to get either Chark with Shenault or Chark with Conley in your best ball stacks, because maybe even Conley would be the better stack option, because that's one of those deals like if neither of those two is going deep, then the Jags just aren't really throwing the ball deep that day, which could happen. But if you can get Conley in like the 20th round to get yourself what is functionally just insurance that in the event that Chark doesn't go deep, that you get points anyway, it's like that's, you know, a pretty low risk insurance policy that could actually be pretty beneficial to you. So that's why the structural reasons of the stacks can pay off. It's just basically like if the price is low enough, you're just getting kind of like free assurance on the prior asset. And there's even the chance, especially when you're talking to Chenault and Chark, there's a chance that they're just both good if Minshew can hold up his peripherals from last year.
You sound like a business school guy. What is this?
Oh yeah, I'm a business school guy for sure. I'm always looking for ways to undermine labor.
Oh God. So shifting gears off of the Jags for a second and looking a little bit closer at this class of receivers, are there any obvious landmines to you that people continue to fall for, you know, in the fifth to the eighth round as far as those receivers go?
Yeah, I don't want to call them landmines because I think they're all going to be good players. Like, I don't think you'll lose this year because you picked these guys. Well, actually, I think you might lose this year because of your Diontae Johnson picks, the people who keep taking him in like the fifth round. But I also don't really like the Seattle pair because Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf are both. I guess Metcalf isn't at max efficiency, but Lockett is. Lockett is insanely efficient. I don't understand how that guy gets the numbers that he does, catching, you know, 80% of his targets every year at a 10 plus yards a target. But that's a player who's too good to disappear, you know, and I'm seeing people paying for Metcalf at these prices that you either have to project more targets. And if you do, they almost necessarily need to be at the expense of Lockett, which I just don't consider a possibility. Or you have to believe the Seahawks throw more, or you have to believe that Metcalf does more per target than he did last year. Now, he only caught 57 of his 100 targets. I would expect him to be more like a 65, 62% catch rate kind of guy going forward. And if he, you know, progressed to that mean, we're over 1,000 yards now. But he wasn't over 1,000 yards last year. It was like 970 or whatever. So at least because there's guys like McLaurin there and guys like Chark, even Gallup, it's like I would rather have Gallup and, you know, certainly Calvin Ridley. Like, I don't think that Lockett and Metcalf offer you enough upside, or I should say plausible upside, because they basically need the other to get hurt, or they need Brian Schottenheimer to get kidnapped before the passing game will be enough to get both of those, or either of those, I should say, receivers to their ceilings. Whereas in my opinion, guys like McLaurin, like, it's just a clear runway. They can just go nuts as it is. Also, Devontae Parker, I think, is in that category for me. Like, he's a good player, and I don't think you got to worry about him just like disappearing on you. But I do think you're running a risk of taking guys like Metcalf, Lockett, Devontae Parker, and I think you risk getting them seeing your 13.5 points per week or whatever and thinking like, oh, that's nice. And then you look at the team beating you, it's like they have Terry McLaurin who you passed on. So that's how I see it breaking down. It's like those guys won't hurt you, but you're passing up some real big upside.
Okay, yeah, and that is the most frustrating thing when it comes to Seattle, because it feels like they're just putting a ceiling on themselves by not turning Russell Wilson loose. And, you know, I'm not sold enough on any of those running backs that they have to even come close to making a case for why they have their offense split that way. But, you know, looking at it in 2018, Seattle threw it only 47.5% of the time. Last year, there was a 7% increase up to 54.3%. And that was still only good enough for 27th in the league. But it certainly would, you know, I think it qualifies as a step in the right direction. So what if, you know, say, for instance, Seattle continues down that road and maybe, you know, ends up being top 20 in pass rate? Do you think that would be something that is A, feasible, and B, something that would make you reconsider? I mean, there's no way of knowing it ahead of time.
Right.
But, you know, would that be something that raises the ceilings for both Lockett and DK for you?
Well, if Wilson throws more, then it's automatic. I mean, it would be a settled matter. Lockett and Metcalf will go as far as that team wants to take them. But they last year, like I think last year might have presented one of the better case game script setups for them, because you had Chris Carson fumbling and getting nicked up. You had Penny getting hurt. You had
the defense being well below its historical standards. And that's that last part, I think, is something everyone's overlooking, particularly in the event. And this is ridiculous that it's coming down to things like this, but particularly in the event that Quentin Dunbar does not get suspended for that ridiculous robbery story, which I don't have any sort of lens to view that one through. That's just some of the weirdest stuff I've ever heard. It sounds pretty bad. But I also haven't heard any, and I haven't seen any reports ever since he like turned himself in, him and the DeAndre Baker incident. Yep, but if Quentin Dunbar, if Dunbar is not suspended, he's maybe a better corner than Shaquille Griffin, who's a really good corner and the only good one they had last year. Like last year, it was pretty easy. You went against the Seahawks. What you do is you go three wide because they stay in the 4-3 base. They'd rather have KJ Wright covering your slot receiver than their third corner. So that's how bad they were at corner last year. And then the second corner, who's still on the field, they can't even find a way to hide this guy, Trey Flowers. You just go at him every play. You throw the ball at the slot receiver who's on the linebacker, and if you're not, you throw it at Trey Flowers because he'll just like interfere with the receiver every time. And so it was way easier to throw the ball on the Seahawks last year than it would be this year if Dunbar's in there giving them, you know, the they don't do shadow coverages ever. They just have their defense loaded out the way it is, and they need each half to do its part. And last year, one half was just flawed with Trey Flowers. Now Dunbar is there. He fits everything they do. He's like a long-armed 6'2 corner, really athletic. And he played receiver at Florida, so that's why he took so long to catch on in the NFL. It wasn't because he lacked athletic talent or anything. It was because he was switching positions. And he really turned a corner the past couple of years, even though he didn't have much, like the Washington pass rush, I guess, was good. But like he was not in as good of a scheme setup as he will be with the Seahawks. Like Dunbar and Griffin are just going to look way better both because of Dunbar being there. And I can see the Seahawks leaning on the run that much more if they get better results from their pass coverage.
Interesting. Okay. All right. So that all tracks. For
sorry, that's so roundabout, but it's like basically, yeah, Dunbar might keep the points down if he doesn't go to jail forever for, I guess, just robbing fake card watches. Games
yeah.
or something. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what. Too weird. I don't have anything on that.
That was such like a, oh my God. But yeah,
cartoonish.
I see what you mean though when it comes to Seattle just being good with, you know, getting into game scripts where they just are running out the clock because their defense is, you know, preventing them from ever falling behind. And, you know, in that case, you don't need Russell Wilson chucking it 35 times and exposing him to getting sacked. He gets sacked a lot, so anytime that you can minimize.
Oh, it's bad. There's no justification for what they do, but that is the way their broken brains work, however.
Yeah, you know, because if it worked 7 years ago, it has to work now.
You know, why would you throw the ball?
Yeah.
If you have a lead, if you're winning, why would you throw the ball? Answer that. Why would you throw it?
Do you want a bigger lead or something? No.
Have you seen what happens, what can happen if you throw the ball? Like, can hit a bird, the bird explodes. Intercepted, maybe you could get sacked. All these bad things can happen if you throw the ball. And
conversely, running the ball only is always good.
You know what? Pete Carroll and Brian Schottenheimer believe in that old football map. I don't know if you saw that. There was some book from like 1939 about like the theory of football, and it was seriously one of those old timey maps that say here be dragons. In the red zone, basically, it would have like these arrows that start at the 0 to 40 and say like opportunity zone, zone of grim determination. And then then you get to the red zone and it's like it literally says, I think, to kick a field goal on first down, because I guess they sucked so much at kicking field goals back then that like half of them would get blocked. So you would need the second and third and fourth down to kick your field goal. They would try not to score a touchdown the closer they were to the end zone. Like that's kind of the that's Pete Carroll's like football ancestor, his immediate ancestor.
My God,
you should look it up. It was an awesome. It's amazing how stupid people were back then. It's like we're dumb now, and we were even dumber back then.
At least we have cool visualizations to let us know how dumb we are nowadays, though. Do you have any other last thoughts you wanted to throw out there on your approach for this NFFC best ball?
Well, I took Will Fuller after Gallup, and that's just because I'm a Fuller truther. I think he works great for best ball setups. Took Tevin Coleman after that. I take Will Fuller and Tevin Coleman in every draft. I'm probably going to take Sammy Watkins later because it's just it's what my role is. But yeah, I'm going to try to get some more shares of like running backs who I think could get snaps if other guys get hurt. And you know, just hope that my prospect background gives me an edge on some of these later picks where I'm assuming some of these other guys are going to have to just be taking names they've never seen before.
Yeah, I think that's definitely going to play to your strengths. The longer that this thing goes on, that definitely will tilt the field in your favor. You know exactly those wide receiver fives on certain teams that just
these
need
guys,
the avenue.
These guys are going to take like Tim Brown in the 20th round or something.
Bozos.
Yeah.
All right, that's going to wrap things up for today's show. From Mario Puig, I'm John McKechnie. Thanks for listening to the RotoWire NFL podcast brought to you by Dynasty.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.